listening to The Lucky Country, brought to you by the publishers of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. My name's Richard Dennis. I'm Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, and I'm a long-time Canberra resident, but a first-time podcaster. Australia's one of the richest countries in the world, and we're living at the richest point in world history. But as Donald Horne observed back in 1964, Australia's a lucky country run mainly by second-rate people who share its luck. Horne went on to say that our leaders so lack curiosity about the events that surround them that they're often taken by surprise. Well, we hope to make a curious podcast for the curious amongst us. Each week we'll shed some new light on some old problems, we'll talk about new ideas, and while we won't lose touch with what's happening in Parliament and across the country, we won't be constrained by it either. This week's episode is called The Wizards of Oz, and over the next half an hour or so, we'll take a close look at the idea that our government spends a lot of time managing the economy. Politicians would have you imagine them in a room fiddling with knobs labelled jobs and levers called growth. This is nonsense, of course. And this week, we'll pull back the curtain in an attempt to show you the truth about what the Wizards of Oz are really up to. Our guests will be the former leader of the Australian Greens, Bob Brown, and the political editor of the Australian Financial Review, Laura Tingle. I'll be chatting to them about how Parliament deals with crises, how it confects them, and potentially how it ignores them. We'll also be talking about what it is Parliament spend their time on that makes a real difference to the country, because in the long run, decisions they make really do matter, some of them at least. At the end of the episode, I'll introduce you to Public Servant X. From time to time, I'll be talking to anonymous former senior public servants to get their unique perspective on what is or isn't going on in the machinery of government. Today, we'll be talking a bit about who actually signs the checks, what it is that happens in the public service when the Parliament's in chaos, and why we don't get the kind of shutdowns and debt ceiling debates in Australia that we do in the US. But first, like Alan Jones before me, let's go to an editorial.
The Leader of the National Party, the Deputy Prime Minister, is qualified to sit in this House, and the High Court will so hold.
Well, that was Malcolm Turnbull providing far more certainty than most constitutional law experts think he's in a position to offer up. And that is, of course, an increasing problem in Australian politics. Politicians want to sound decisive, they want to sound certain, but they're starting to make promises they can't possibly keep. And as a result, the Australian public is paying less and less attention to the promises they do make. In the long run, that's not just a problem for the politicians. That's a problem for our democracy as well, because we need our Parliament to make promises on our behalf, but having made them, we want to believe that they'll work as hard as they can to deliver on them. In addition to talking about managing the economy, we hear politicians talk endlessly about the need to provide certainty, the need to give business and even consumers confidence. And this is used as a rationale for effectively saying we have to do exactly what the government said it wanted to do, exactly when it said it wanted to do it, or otherwise business will lose confidence and the economy will grind to a halt. But of course it's impossible for anyone, government or anyone else, to give business certainty or consumers certainty. There's no such thing as certainty in capitalism. We saw an extreme example of this recently when Malcolm Turnbull came out to say that he was certain that the High Court would find that Barnaby Joyce and indeed other government MPs would be free to sit in Parliament. Certain. No one can be certain of what the High Court will or won't find. That's for the High Court to decide. But we've created this notion where we need, as leaders, to offer certainty that we're now promising certainty where none can actually be provided. This doesn't help business, this doesn't help our democracy, and in turn it doesn't really help the credibility of a Prime Minister who's writing checks that he is in no position to cash. So if as a society we want to offer as much certainty as we can, be it to business or to taxpayers, we should admit when there's uncertainty. The last thing we should do is promise people things we can't deliver. We should be upfront and honest with them so that business can plan for the things that are uncertain and it can bank on the things that are certain. When prime ministers start making big promises they can't keep, it's no surprise that people stop paying much attention to what prime ministers say.
It stands to reason, then, that the way you ensure that strong growth continues is to make sure that every lever of government economic policy is pulling in the direction of encouraging investment. Everything our government does is focused on powering economic growth.
I've been living in Canberra for around 17 years, and the whole time I've lived here, I've heard people, politicians in particular, talking about the way that the economy is managed. We talk about pulling levers and fine-tuning the economy. But of course, there's no room with levers and dials. There's no place where Scott Morrison or Joe Hockey or any former treasurer can go to manage the economy, because these are just metaphors. The economy, the Australian economy, the thing we hear so much about, is just the collective effort of 24 million Australians going to work, making things, buying things, shipping things, inventing things. There's plenty that politicians do that can affect the economy, particularly in the long run, but the fine-tuning, the lever-pulling and the managing the economy that they make so much of, well, it's really a figment of their imagination. Now, this is not unique to the current government. Indeed, it's not even unique to the federal government. State treasurers and state premiers seek election promising to manage the economy well. And both sides of politics certainly make these claims. Vote for me and I'll manage the economy well. There's no doubt that the decisions our politicians make can affect the economy. If we look around the world, we see that some countries have made much better decisions than others. But the fact that politicians can and do make important decisions sometimes is different from the fact that they spend all day long managing the economy on our behalf. I'm an economist, and what most economists would admit is that the economy has a much bigger impact on the budget. The economy has a much bigger effect on government than governments have on the economy. That is, most of what we hear about, whether it's the budget deficit, whether it's the unemployment rate, or whether it's the trade balance, these are things that are influenced beyond Australia's borders. These are things that are influenced by the decisions that most of us make in our daily lives. And these are things that politicians in turn have to respond to. But the idea that they're in charge of it is a convenient myth. Like the Wizard of Oz, our treasurers like to stand up and declare that they have all these powerful levers and tools at their disposal. But in reality, what's actually happening is they're surfing the waves that are sent their way by the world economy, by the national economy, or by technological change that nobody saw coming. Of course, this doesn't mean that nothing they do matters. On the contrary, from time to time, knowing which wave to catch is very important. From time to time, knowing when to intervene in the economy is very important. Back in the midst of the GFC, for example, the Australian government intervened quite effectively to try and stimulate a flailing economy. Countries around the world made worse decisions, and in turn they had much worse outcomes. But the fact that every now and then there's a big call to make is different from all day long that they're in there managing the economy on our behalf. Most of what happens in our economy can't even be predicted. For example, back in the 1980s, who could have imagined that mobile phones would be everywhere? Back in the 1990s, who could have imagined that the internet or smartphones would be everywhere? These new technologies come along not because some parliamentary committee willed them to be so. They came along because someone invented them and because lots of people wanted to buy them. Similarly, renewable energy, not only a great way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it's fast becoming a great way to reduce the cost of making electricity. Of course, our politicians are rapidly playing catch-up, trying to reconcile the politics of which technology they like with the economics of the fact that things like solar and wind-powered electricity are getting cheaper and cheaper by the day. Whether or not politicians make good policies, about renewable energy, about different technologies, can make a huge impact in the long run, as we're seeing at the moment. For 20 years, we've seen paralysis in Australia about energy policy, with people using things like climate policy and energy policy as great political fodder to have daily fights about. But the consequence of that is that there's been a massive failure to invest not just in new sources of energy, but in energy efficiency and in changing the way our grid works. The high prices we're paying for electricity today are a direct response, a direct consequence of parliamentary paralysis about getting big picture policies sorted out. But of course, having created that crisis, there's no easy way out. Malcolm Turnbull can fly to the Snowy River in a helicopter. He can announce an inquiry into whatever he wants. But it will actually take years, if not decades, to transform our electricity system in ways that will deliver cheap electricity and a clean environment. So the decisions that our parliamentarians make, they matter, but they don't matter tomorrow. It's often said that the internet, in terms of the internet, people overestimate the impact it will have tomorrow and underestimate the impact it will have on us in 5 years' time. Well, that's kind of how it works with the economy and the role of politicians in managing the economy. There's not much we can do in Parliament tomorrow that will fix unemployment. There's not much we can do in Parliament tomorrow that will close the gender pay gap, address Indigenous disadvantage, or significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But there's much we can do that will set Australia up in the decades to come. So for our political class who enjoy, it seems, so much to debate whether or not or how best to resolve issues like same-sex marriage rather than to address issues like same-sex marriage, the time we spend having these process fights, the time dedicated to defending whether Barnaby Joyce should or shouldn't be a minister right now, is time that our parliament isn't spending addressing the problems that are emerging for Australia and indeed the opportunities for Australia. So if we want to talk about the economy, if we want to talk about what politicians can do to help the economy, I think we need to raise our sights quite significantly. The idea that they can tinker and manage and fix the economy tomorrow is nonsense. But what, of course, they can do is on our behalf make big decisions about what to invest in, whether to invest in more education, whether to invest in more infrastructure, whether to invest more in renewable energy, or, of course, whether to invest less. These are the big choices that our parliament has to deal with on our behalf. If they get them right, then history suggests that we'll all benefit from that. Of course, what's right and what's wrong? Well, these are questions that are always in the eye of the beholder. But not many people looking at the Australian education system today would think that the last 20 years of policy has set us up well. Not many people looking at the electricity system today would think the last 20 years has set us up well. We are still one of the richest countries in the world, but that's probably because we inherited so much natural wealth and we've had such stable government and such fortunate run of world events where no wars have been fought on our soil. But whether or not we thrive in this century or not is going to have far more to do with the decisions we make today than it is with the resources we inherited in the past. Whether we get that right or not is a big decision, a much bigger and much more important decision than whether we tinker with interest rates or the size of the budget deficit in the coming weeks or months. But whether our parliament is up to making those big decisions, to focusing on the right problems or not, well, time will tell. But we'll be joined shortly by two guests who are very well positioned to give us some advice on that. Former leader of the Australian Greens, Bob Brown, and current political editor of the Australian Financial Review, Laura Tingle. I'll be talking to them in a moment about how it is that the agenda is set, who's in charge of deciding what's important, and whether or not the Twitter and podcasts and social media that have now come to dominate so much of our media are helping us to address these big issues or getting in the way of it. Bob Brown and Laura Tingle, thank you very much for joining me on The Lucky Country and for being my first ever guests. Bob, let's start with you. You've spent decades in state and federal parliament. You've been involved in countless parliamentary and political debates and indeed votes. Do you think that politicians sometimes have a tendency to get caught up in the excitement of the moment?
Not sometimes, but very much of the time. very distracting from the business of the parliament, which is guiding the future of the nation. It's as simple as that. And having a vision about where the nation's going and working towards the good of the nation and those who are going to be living in it coming down the line.
Laura, you spend your life covering what's happening in parliament or what's happening in press conferences. Can you tell when you're listening, whether you're listening to something significant or just froth and bubbles? How do you tell?
Well, there's always a bit of all of those things, I think, Richard. I mean, one of the things when you're attending a press conference like that, you're listening for the headline, if you like. You're listening for the news headline. So sometimes it sort of takes away from the fact that there might be something momentous involved. But often and increasingly, because there's just this sort of relentless nature of press conferences, television appearances and everything else, I think, politicians are often saying less and less or they're talking more and more about less and less.
Bob, I'm sure you were never guilty of that. How does a politician see it? Are all those press conferences important to build a big picture story, or do they simply have to be used to deal with the story of the day?
I think I was guilty of it along with everybody else, because you're asked at the Senate doors about a lot of things, much of which is trivial, to get the headline that Laura was talking about. By a mixture of media who are, after all, looking to whet the public appetite or have something sensational. But if you were to get off cue and talk about something much greater, more important even, or grander, you could see the pencils go down and the eyes roll, and it wasn't to do with Parliament that day, so how dare a parliamentarian bring it up and talk about it? You go along with the flow or become irrelevant to some degree. The art is, of course, making sure that where there are important issues, that you also find a way or force a way for those issues onto the agenda.
What do you think, Laura? Is the media there to let politicians force something new onto the agenda, or is the agenda set by the Prime Minister and everyone else just needs to go along with it?
Well, I think it's a mixture, Richard. I mean, Bob's right. You get to the doors if you're a politician and you might be asked about, whatever the running story of the day is. Now, that's not necessarily in the control of either the media or the Prime Minister of the day. For example, North Korea letting off an atomic test, that's beyond all of our control, but obviously you're going to be asked about it. And I suppose that's an example of the fact that I think all politicians, including all the Prime Ministers I've ever seen, sort of all hope that somehow they're going to be able to control the news cycle on a day. And it never happens, and they're always disappointed. But equally, we don't control the news cycle either. I mean, for example, on the day we're recording this, the big story is all about energy policy and what's going to happen to Liddell Power Station. But we're working also with rumours that there might be a decision from the High Court on the same-sex marriage plebiscite this afternoon, and that will obviously just knock any coverage we've got of the energy issue off the front pages. So it's a dynamic sort of environment, and politicians are required to adjust to that. And there's sort of this frustration and a difficulty in both dealing with those issues that come up that aren't necessarily things you want to talk about, and also having the capacity to cut through and get people to talk about the issues you do want to talk about.
Well, on that, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of politicians, a lot of commentators say that, you know, these days with social media, it's all so much harder to have a sustained, sensible conversation. But while I don't doubt for a minute that social media has changed the way that we can communicate with each other, there seem to be plenty of other countries around the world that have Twitter, and they still seem to be able to have more sophisticated debates than ours. So as a representative of the so-called old media, what do you think at the Fin? How has social media changed things, or is that just an excuse used by politicians that can't keep up?
Oh, look, I think social media does have a huge distraction factor. A story will go online and this immediate brawl will start about why the story was written, you know, disputing whether the story's true, you know, all these sorts of things. But more importantly than that is, I don't think it's so much social media, it's the fact that the resources available to give people sort of reliable information, to give them the context, which is always important, to authoritatively say, well, you know, this is all that you need to know about making your own opinion about this decision. The resources to do that have disappeared. I mean, I always use the example of our own bureau for the Financial Review here in Canberra. There were 12 of us in 2013. There are 4 of us now. That means that you all start to be generalists. You know, you don't necessarily cover any particular policy area every day of the week, so you just jump into it with the broadest of general knowledge around that subject. You won't have as good contacts in that area. You won't know as many experts in the area. So you tend to then see the world through a political prism, because that's safe. You know, is it good for the government? Is it bad for the government? That sort of thing. And that dumbs down what you're telling your readers, because you can't give them the history of an issue in a few paths. You can't tell them, you know, what all the people from a wide range of perspectives necessarily think about it.
And you've got to deal with all the instant experts on Twitter as well. Bob, sounds like you might have retired from Parliament just in time. What do you think? Social media, friend or foe? Once upon a time, if you couldn't get on the Channel 9 News at night, you couldn't get yourself heard. Now you can tweet like Donald Trump or show up on a podcast like this. Is this a good thing for democracy or something terrifying?
Well, I think as Laura said, it's a mixture, but it can be a very big distraction, everybody having their opinion. But what Parliament is set to do is to be the amalgam of the national opinion, and it should be well informed, and the media is relied upon to pass on good information, so that good decisions are made on behalf of the nation. I guess in a way Parliament is a concentration of that sort of Twitter to and fro. And unfortunately, the things that get covered are the outrageous statements are made and the personal abuse and accusations, rather than the grand ideas. And I think we're missing something very important there. I get asked frequently as I go around the country now talking about the fact that the human population of 8 billion is already using 150% of the Earth's living renewable resources. We're living beyond the Earth's ability to replenish it, and we're going for a 300% increase on that if we have growth economics working well by the end of this century, and that can't happen. And people come up and say, why didn't you say that while you're in Parliament? Well, I say, well, I did, but nobody ever covered that, and nobody was interested in it, and the opposition would roll their eyes and walk out. In a way, Parliament does reflect who we are as human beings, with all our grand ideas, but also all our shortcomings. And it does well to reflect upon that, and parliamentarians will do well to reflect upon that. It's a great privilege to be there, but finding a way of rising above the Twitter level of, or not just the Twitter, but the interchange of opinions, to come to a consensus viewpoint that's going to be good for the future is desperately needed by, always has been.
What do you think?
By parliaments.
What do you think, Laura? Is Dick Smith's, you know, accusing the ABC of a conspiracy for not talking about population? I presume the Fin are probably to be included in that conspiracy as well. Or is it more important to talk about whether the Deputy Prime Minister is duly elected to the Parliament? Is it the participants in the Parliament or the issues that they discuss that are more likely to be on the front page of any newspaper tomorrow?
it's always a battle. It's sort of a raging argument going on, whether it's on Twitter or in the Parliament, that constitutes news of the day. It's sort of interesting to me that, you know, in this world where everybody thinks that the Prime Minister, if not the government, is going to fall any day of the week now, people want to know about issues like Barnaby Joyce's citizenship. The population issue is a particular one which I have a bee in my bonnet about, because I think we don't talk about it in the same way we don't talk about immigration as we used to, in the sense that while we spend a lot of time and effort on keeping a few people who arrived by boats in the news, the fact that we have several hundred thousand permanent arrivals arriving every year, which record levels of population growth in Australia, which has immense implications for the economy, I think there is sort of a bit of a conspiracy of silence about that, partly because both sides of politics know that population growth is actually a very important economic driver, and that the population is, if it just keeps going as it will get to the sorts of levels that Kevin Rudd used to talk about when he talked about big Australia. But Australians are a bit alarmed about that. They don't feel comfortable with the idea, and it readily sort of runs off the edges into issues about, dare one say, xenophobia and race, about border protection, about a whole range of issues about infrastructure. And I think my take on it is that both sides of politics just think it's too hard an issue. You know, they don't feel competent to actually be able to run this issue and keep control of it, because they saw what happened when Kevin Rudd popped his head up on it in, I think, 2008 or 2009.
Yeah, so, Bob, you know, in Parliament House, it's hardly full of shrinking violets, and people there aren't opposed to a bit of conflict and a bit of disagreement. Why do you think people are afraid of having a debate about something like population as opposed to asylum seeker policy? Why is it easier to argue about the small flow of asylum seekers than the large immigration levels that have had bipartisan support for so long?
Well, I think Dick Smith's got his alarm bells going about this, but I think Laura alluded to it just now. It's really tied up with growth economics and the future of our society. We need prosperity, but can we continue to consume more out of a finite planet? And the answer ultimately is no, we can't. So how are we going to make that transfer? And one of the things about the population debate is that ultimately, there were 2.5 billion people when I came onto the planet in 1944. There's 8 billion now. It's more than tripled. We just can't keep that going. And internally, we had the debate about Australia, and Laura's quite right. It's the immigration policy which is actually leading to the fairly rapid growth in Australia's population. And ultimately, that can mean a decline in living standards rather than increase. And I tried very hard in Parliament, and my subsequent colleagues have, to look at the option of, because it is tied to growth economics, a big section of that immigration is people who can pay $750,000 to come into the country, or who have high skills, which would be much better off used back in their poorer countries, or who are well off. A very, very small section come as refugees compared to that number. And the question is, have we got that mix right? I don't think we have.
Well, Bob, just to close it out, we've talked about some big things today, things that, as you say, are perhaps hard to get press for, but you've just heard Laura say she thinks it's the kind of issue that needs more ventilation as well. Any cheap advice for citizens or current parliamentarians on how we can do a better job of this? Why does our debate shy away from the big long-term issues? And what's your cheap advice for perhaps how we could do it better?
Parliament's only as good as the voters. As Churchill said, if you want to see what's wrong with democracy, have a 3-minute discussion with an average voter. Well, I wouldn't quite go that far, but I do think that voters have got to stop complaining about politicians, because the Parliament almost exactly, as J.K. Galbraith said, almost exactly reflects the people who vote for it. There are good options, and people who are really upset with Parliament should think about standing for it. This is a democracy. Everybody's able to take part in it. And criticism's cheap, but actually action takes a little bit more. And I think democracy is the best system. We've got one of the oldest continuous democracies on the planet. it's absolutely pivotal to the future of this country, and a little less criticism and more involvement in it, more action taking, would be a good thing on behalf of every citizen, I think.
Bob Brown, Laura Tingle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Joining me now is Servant X for today. We're not going to reveal his name, but we are going to reveal his insight. Servant X is a former senior public servant from the Department of Finance, and thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Richard.
We hear a lot about parliamentary chaos. We hear a lot about the inability to pass legislation through the parliament. As a former senior public servant, how does that affect the day-to-day work of the hundreds of thousands of public servants in Australia? Mm.
The vast majority of public servants are not really affected by much of what happens on a day-to-day basis in Parliament. Most public servants are doing things like processing Centrelink payments for age pensions, Medicare benefits. A large number are in the tax office, obviously collecting tax. Other big departments of defence, supporting the defence establishment, and immigration are another very large department. So most of the people are doing things they would do every day. They are doing regardless of whether Parliament's sitting or not, and regardless of whether Parliament's in uproar.
That sounds like a relief. Now, we were talking before about the cheques. Who actually signs the cheques? When government pays money, is that the finance minister sitting there writing the big cheques?
I don't think many people actually sign cheques anymore, but in terms of transfers of money, the most legislation has the minister has delegated to officials, senior officials in the department to approve payments. So it's public servants who do the approval. Obviously, within the guidelines set by the legislation, and also sometimes the guidelines set by ministers, which is very tightly determined exactly who can be paid and how much they can be paid. And I think the general public has a difficulty understanding the vast sums of money that the government spends, and the government is the biggest business in the country. And so everything the government does, it's normally a big number. And people get frightened by big numbers because it's really totally out of their understanding sometimes. And that's most obviously manifest in the discussion about the debt. The debt of net debt is $350 billion, something like that. That's a huge number. And the interest bill each day is very large compared to most
people's incomes.
That's right. But at that level, not saying we don't need to do something to reduce it, and we've got to be aware of it. It's less than 1 year's income for the government.
So
now, as I said, I would think most people, if their mortgage was less than 1 year's of their net income, that'd be pretty comfortable.
So you're saying, for all of the talk about millions and billions of dollars that governments spend and owe, we haven't really done a very good job of explaining to the public what that means.
Yeah, that's right. Every number is very large, and that's why even when it comes to savings, people think, well, I can see inefficiencies here. I can get the budget into surplus by cutting this and cutting that. But realistically, age pension is 14% of the budget. Defence is 6%. Things like Medicare benefits, pharmaceutical benefits, when you add it up in the top 12 programs like that, you're talking about 85% of the budget. By cutting the ABC, you're not actually doing much to address the budget deficit.
So are you saying that spending millions of dollars or slashing programs by $1 million is really rounding error?
Nowadays, budget, I think a lot of budgeting now is fiddling around the edges. There's a lot of locked in at the moment, and there's a lot of resistance to making a lot of changes, because if you really have to change things, that you have to hit that 85%. And a lot of people are very wedded to age pensions. Medicare benefits.
Especially the old and the sick.
And quite rightly so.
Yeah. All right, well, Servant X, thank you very much for coming in and giving the public at large the advice of a public servant. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A lot of public debate these days starts from the premise that everyone participating is an expert on everything. Well, obviously that's not the case. I don't know about everything, and I doubt you do either. So if there's something that you've always wondered about, if there's some bit of economics in particular you think I can help explain to you, then feel free to send in questions, because if we all admit what we don't know, if we all ask questions when we need answers, then perhaps we can all have a better public debate. So feel free to send your emails in to theluckycountry@swartzmedia.com.au. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Swartz Media production, brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. You can email us at theluckycountry@swartzmedia.com.au. The show is produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with another edition of The Lucky Country next week. Thank you for listening.